Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 386.LK2417, certificate number 28450, the Dumont Network.
Post, P-O-S-T, P-O-S-T, the cereals you like the most, the cereals made by Post, take you to the secret mountain retreat of Captain Video, electronic wizard. Master of time and space, guardian of the safety of the world.
I guess we should explain.
Why would we start doing that at this late date?
Never apologize, never explain. Well, we should probably explain, we come from a time when broadcast television networks still exist, barely. Mm-hmm. And not just that, but we come from a distant time when they actually had, the major networks had identities. They had personalities,
which they kind of would monkey with, right? Sometimes
right.
They were like,
depending on what hit.
Yeah, we're gonna. Oh, now we're the laugh. We're the fun network.
Because you are. If I remember right, we've talked about this adjacent stuff before. And if I remember right, you were very much a product of your mid to late 70s childhood. You're an ABC kid.
There was a long ABC era, but in the 1970s, I remember very much being a CBS kid.
What were you watching on the Tiffany Network?
Well, let's see. What was on CBS at the time? I mean, what?
I don't even know.
Who had Happy Days?
All those shows are ABC.
That's like, ABC.
So yeah. ABC was the number one network of 1976 on because they had the family-friendly comedy block of Happy Days and its many spinoffs, Mork and Mindy and Laverne and Shirley. And then after that, Three's Company, which was, and its spinoffs, which were a little naughtier. But they also had these kind of glitzy fantasy shows. They were the network of Charlie's Angels and Love Boat and Fantasy Island, like real eye candy, no brain candy
stuff. So what CBS had was Mary Tyler Moore. It had...
They had MASH. You're old enough to be watching the smart socially...
That's what it was. It was MASH made me a CBS kid, but it also had My Three Sons. It had Good Times. And Bob Newhart.
Did it have all the Norman Lear stuff? Yes, right? Yeah. It would have had Archie
all
Bunker.
All in the Family.
And, yeah.
So this was the stuff that...
you were from a good liberal home.
The Jeffersons. We didn't watch the Waltons, but definitely watched Kojak, Bob Newhart, Gunsmoke, Maude. So it was Norman Lear and MASH.
So you come from a time when CBS dominated the ratings. And I think anybody slightly younger than you, and that includes me, would be surprised to hear that ABC was not a viable network until a Happy Days,
yeah.
You know, like they never had, if you look at the 1960s, there's whole years when ABC does not have a hit show. Like Bewitched is like their lone show
really
in the top 20 for much of the 1960s.
What was Magnum PI? It was CBS too. Magnum was CBS, right?
I associate Magnum with, see, my problem is I watched all these TV shows in Korea on when there was. To me, they're all Armed Forces Network shows. Oh. Magnum NBC, I think. Yes, Magnum was on. Or no, is that just the revival? I think the Selleck one was too.
No. I'm sure. Because NBC really had its rise
in
like...
It was both. It moved. No, wait. That's the new one. Yes, you're right. It was on CBS. I guess maybe it was... I think Miami Vice might have been NBC. Oh, so like later, okay. You know, later in the 80s, the cool cop shows become...
Yeah, because I remember the flip over to like NBC. Well, NBC always had Saturday Night Live.
Right.
So that was cool. But yeah, and a lot of this had to do also with who anchored the nightly news.
Right.
So CBS was Dan Rather.
Yeah. Or Cronkite if you're old enough. Cronkite
originally, right. Yeah.
And so you would just stay with your nightly news, because America would watch the same nightly newscast. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. And NBC was Peter Jennings?
No, NBC was Brokaw.
Brokaw.
ABC had Peter Jennings.
Okay, right.
And that was kind of a steady state, weirdly.
Sure.
Rather, Brokaw and Jennings, that's like maybe 25 unbroken years, weirdly.
Yeah.
And so that kind of shaped a generation. The identities were news and late night, of course. Are you watching Carson or are you watching Ted Koppel?
Of course you're watching Carson.
Yeah. And there's really no alternative until, we'll discuss, until the competitors came up.
But, all of our Gen Z listeners in the tens of thousands.
They have stopped listening already.
And even millennial listeners might be going, huh?
Gen Z by now is all playing The Sims on their phone.
The thing is, they were doing that and listening to the show already.
We're kind of a second screen experience, John, wouldn't you say?
Third screen.
Like, ABC never led the ratings until 1976. I think they never had a number one show until Marcus Welby in 1970.
That's insane to me.
So for the first, like, 25 to 30 years of TV, ABC is like a redheaded stepchild. Yeah.
How strange. And you know what? As you say that, I think I can think of a time when each of the three networks was regarded as the underdog.
Right.
Right? The scrappy underdog that's like clawing its way back.
In the early 80s, nobody was watching NBC, and then suddenly they reinvented themselves with the sitcoms, that Cosby Family Ties Cheers block.
Yeah.
And they kind of became the comfort food sitcom network on and off until The Office, really, you know, for the next more than 20 years.
And I bet you there are people listening who are thinking of this only in terms of soap operas. Because soap operas were also so very networked.
During the day, of course, I only watch my ABC soaps. Yeah, you're right. So it depends on what your day part is. But, you know, these identities that now doesn't exist. You know, I guess to some degree, maybe the streaming services still have personalities. Like, this feels more like
an Apple show.
This is an HBO show.
But that might be. Sucks, right? Because they've screwed it up. Now we all have to pay $15 a month for what? How much do those TV?
I think a lot of the services are now $15 a month.
Are they really?
Yeah.
And so you have to subscribe to how many of them?
I would say if you want everything that might get talked about at work, it's 5 or 6. You can probably lose Peacock.
So you're doing $100 a month, more or less.
Yeah, whereas your cable bill might have been half that and it had sports.
Oh, but you're not paying for cable? You're just paying for the 5 stations?
Yeah, I think in general, people have now cut the cord unless they are absolutely
sports
loyal to the NFL or something else.
So you do the 4 or the 5, and then but you still have to pay the internet cost, right?
Yes.
You're paying for internet.
Are you not aware of who pays your bills? You're not aware of how this works?
Well, I don't have a TV. So it's all news to me.
I have bad news for you about today's show, Mr. I don't have a TV.
I mean, I watch TV at other people's houses. I just don't know how much they pay for.
You don't know their infrastructure.
No, not at all.
They should start charging you at the door, I think.
Early on, when all of this started happening, Jonathan Colton, I spent a lot of time at his house watching TV. As I would fly to New York for 10 days.
You were like, well, I haven't seen any of these HBO shows.
But one of the great things is that his wife, Christine, likes watching movies during the day.
Ooh.
Which I can never find somebody who wants to do.
In the theater or at home?
At home. Oh. So we would wake up, we'd have coffee, we'd sit around, and then the kids would go to school or whatever, and she'd be like, want to watch a movie? It'd be like 11 a.m. And I would go, that just feels so decadent. Like, what kind of movie? And she'd pull out some like heavy adult film. And we would watch movies all day. It was the greatest thing I ever experienced.
This is your life hack? Watch Sophie's Choice at 11 a.m.
Except it has to be at somebody else's house. If you do it at your own house, something's gone wrong. But his philosophy was sign up for everything. That's a cost of life. And if you're paying $200 a month and you have everything, then you never have to worry. You have to have $200 a month to spend on TV.
My life hack, because I'm a deeply weird person, is you make a spreadsheet of what you want to watch, and then you you alternate.
That can't be true.
Okay, we're getting Hulu for 3 months, so everybody pack it in. But then as soon as the next season of Reservation Dogs comes out, we're going to watch that. We're dropping Hulu, and we're back on Apple TV, because that's when we're going to watch Silo.
You cannot be serious.
No, this is an amazing way to live. I think everyone should adopt this plan.
I just had a huge insight into the way Dylan and Kaz have been raised and what they face in life.
The challenges they must overcome. Well, the thing is, young people don't actually care that much. Like, if Dylan finds out, if Dylan wants to watch something on Paramount Plus and I'm like, LOL, we're not getting Paramount Plus. Right. He'll be like, okay. And I assume he is pirating it. Is the FCC listening to this? I'm sorry, Star Trek.
I don't even know how to begin to understand what pirating is and how you would go about doing that.
See, that's good. You're so innocent.
I am such a, just an old.
Well, let me talk about how TV is maybe older even than we would imagine. I think it would surprise a lot of people to know that if you're vaguely aware, you know of TV's tipping point, maybe right around 1950, suddenly everybody's mm-hmm. watching Uncle Milty. But I think it would surprise many people to hear that, like, the technology of TV broadcasting actually predated the culture of network TV by decades.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the series of technological advances that led to video signal being able to be broadcast over, you know, VHF and UHF frequencies. I mean, that's the 1920s, if not more. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, a lot of that became commercial broadcast, although not terribly commercial. Like, in the 20s, General Electric would actually telecast stuff from its Schenectady plant where they were working on TV. But you know who was watching? All the
UFOs.
Yeah, aliens. They were watching Jesse Owens or whatever.
It was just microwaving the people in the 10 miles around. Yeah,
everybody
the plant.
Who lived too close to the plant was like, "Why is this side of my face so red? Is this Milton Berle's fault?" No, it was actually the engineers who worked at the plant and who were all television hobbyists. To me, it's kind of who were watching these broadcasts, because
they
were tinkering at home.
Right, but there was no consumer level of this.
You couldn't
this.
Go to a department store yet. You'd have to. It was, I think, the best analogy might be, 80s and 90s computer bulletin boards.
Yeah, sure.
Where it all existed, you could use your phone line to get on the prototype of the internet.
But who would?
But it was just a bunch of weirdos who went to Radio Shack.
Yeah, right.
It was just hobbyists, basically.
So you had to live within a certain radius around the GE building?
Or a Westinghouse plant or something. And of course, by the 30s, it's clear that America has entered a new age of mass broadcast entertainment, but it's over the radio. It's
right. But let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I would expect that this technology would have been used in World War II if it was already decades old, but I don't remember, except for a very few Marvel-based commercial properties.
Is that where you get all your World War II pop culture?
Well, nowadays, although I used to sit in libraries, but I don't remember a single instance of Nazis sitting and using video screens to do anything.
You think they should be watching Hogan's Heroes or whatever?
Or just, you know, I don't know what you would do, but it seems like we think of the war as advancing these technologies.
It was a huge interregnum for television, in fact.
I love that we use that word all the time.
That we made up. Television, like, basically, television advances through the 30s. I mean, even as big companies, what are today CBS and NBC, are being built around their radio networks and the big stars they have coast to coast, TV sucks. There's nothing on. Occasional bursts of programming go out, but, you know, basically there's no one to watch it.
At what point was a TV available for sale in a store?
The turning point is pretty much the 1947 World Series. Like, there's a decade of, well, I mean, so in 1939, FDR opens the World's Fair over TV. And this is the, World's Fairs are always, these expos are very future looking. And particularly that one had a Trilon and a Perisphere, and here's the 20th century.
That's what you want, a Trilon and a Perisphere.
We're out of the Depression. In this economy, a Trilon and a Perisphere?
Wait a minute, in 1939, are we out of the Depression? This seems like some revisionism.
Well, because you're a World War II ended the Depression kind of a guy.
That's what they told me in the books I read in the library.
America is hopeful and whistling.
Right.
They're whistling, happy days are here again.
Happy days are
See, and then that leads straight into Fonzie and Potsy.
Well, I guess, you know, there was a lot, that big band music really uplifted people's spirits.
Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, on the radio, sure, you got people listening to Swing. On TV, you know, when even the FDR becomes the first president to appear on TV opening the World's Fair, and thousands of people see that, but mostly in the New York area because there are little, mm-hmm. The New York radio stations, some of them have TV transmitters. But all these programs that you could watch, even if you basically put together your TV kit at home, they're not series. It's not a weekly thing. It's just, hey, the president's opening the World's Fair tonight. Let's go to your nerdy friend that might have a set where we could watch that. It's a tiny number of people.
You know, when I was dating my ex-girlfriend who lived in California and worked in the tech enterprises,
yeah,
she had a house in Venice Beach, and for a little while, she was committed to the idea that we were going to decorate using really old televisions, and I mean the ones that had prism,
yeah,
glass in front of, because the screen was only as big as a book.
Like a Terry Gilliam one.
Yeah, and then they had big, like, magnifying glasses.
Were they going to be working, or were there going to be plants in there?
No, working. And so we scoured Southern California for working televisions, and, they were not inexpensive because, again, nerds.
Yeah. There's a resale market for these now, if they work, right?
Yeah, and then at a certain point, we abandoned that because we were a very attention deficit disorder couple.
Is this?
I think we went into decorating with kick drum pedals.
Is this a sign that your relationship is doomed if your significant other wants Terry Gilliam prism TV sets all over the house?
No, in fact, that was maybe our relationship at its most focused.
That was the highest point.
We were like, we are on a common cause, baby. We're going to decorate with televisions.
If you had just stayed at flea markets more, you guys would still be together.
Yeah, no, it's true.
The government got in the act in 1941 and started giving out commercial licenses and said, okay, you're a station, you can broadcast at this frequency, this
We've
strength.
Talked about this before, the apportionment of frequency.
Yeah, the apportionment is a big part of this particular story because the government realized correctly that this was a very finite resource. That's not true in the streaming era. I mean, I guess there's bandwidth issues that net neutrality is adjacent to.
Not for those of us that still have our AT&T unlimited calling plans.
The math was very easy back then. There can only be so many VHF channels.
Does television take up a lot more bandwidth than radio?
Yeah. I'm actually not going to look it up. I'm just going to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wide bandwidth. Yeah.
I mean, there was still a channel one at the time, but for decades and, there's between 12 and 13 VHF channels. Yeah. That's it.
We watch channel zero.
Wait, what is that a reference to?
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
Because it makes it better for those few futurelings who feel more smart.
We
watch Planet Zero. That's a clue.
Okay, I'll Google that later. But as I say, the watershed moment for getting these things into people's living rooms was actually, of all things, baseball. What could be bigger in 1947 than the Brooklyn Dodgers playing the New York Yankees?
Yes.
So it's a Subway Series. It's, it's Dodgers, so it's DiMaggio and Yogi Berra and Gil Hodges and all the rest. And it's the Dodgers, so it's all their stars plus the... Wait, did I say Gil Hodges was a Yankee? Maybe he was...
You're going to get letters.
Oh, boy. I don't want old people yelling at me.
Yeah, this is some Brighton Beach memoir stuff here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Baseball as the American currency.
And in 1947, of course, the Dodgers have their new phenom sensation rookie of the year, Jackie Robinson.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Bob, he watched Channel Zero.
Yeah, Hodges was a Dodger, of course. I know that. I have a Hodges bobblehead that I got when they put him in the Dodgers Hall of Fame last year, which I did not want.
If your son Dylan still listens to this program...
He's so angry right now.
He's really mad.
He's like, Dad, stomping around. I play Immaculate... He plays this game called Immaculate Grid, where you're trying to select 9 ball players that will fill this baseball Sudoku.
From history.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it's like, okay, so wait. Brewers Angels. Who do I know that played for both the Brewers and the Angels? And you get points if you pick a less popular choice.
I feel like this is civilizational sink.
Well, I mean, maybe it's better. The kids are going back to baseball.
Yeah, the beautiful ones are just grooming themselves.
I see. Instead of having sex, they're keeping full score at major league games. But this is a huge cultural event. I mean, New York is still the center of American culture, so of course there. But I mean,
thank goodness.
It's estimated that 3.5 million people watch this seven-game series.
On what television?
Most of them in bars.
Oh.
I think it's almost 4 million overall, but 3.5 million are watching in bars.
Is this people standing out on sidewalks watching TVs in department store windows?
Oh, I think it is, because it's not. This is the thing that makes people think, you know, we should have a set.
Uh-huh.
Because maybe one person in the building has a TV. you were alive for that? I was alive for we should get a color set, mom and dad.
Yeah.
I was tired of watching Sesame Street in black and white.
My mom's boyfriend's mother in 1976, she was a little grandma, and she had a portable television that she gave me as a birthday present. And it was my own television. Of course, I was not allowed to watch it at my leisure. I was given strict rules, but I had my own TV. It wasn't anywhere near as, it wasn't color. Our color TV was a big thing that had a record player in it, you know, some ginormous piece of furniture, but I had my own TV. I preferred to watch it because it belonged to me and it was the size of a microwave oven.
I think I was not in high school till my parents said I could have a little TV in my room, but you're right. There's the sense of ownership.
This is my TV.
When you're watching on your TV.
I'm going to watch MASH in black and white on my TV.
Ted Koppel on my TV. Now, by the time 1947 rolls around and people have seen, you know what, I could actually watch the playoffs at home. There are already TV networks. You know, the original transmitters are just, you know, the FDA, the FCC is giving licenses to a tower in New York or in Philadelphia or whatever. But by this time.
But aren't they just radio networks?
Yeah, the first two are. The originals are, for the most part, like at the time that television kind of makes its bow with the 47 World Series, there are two big players in the TV network space. There's NBC
mm-hmm.
and there's DuMont. These are the two front runners.
What?
When it comes to networking your regional TV stations into a group that all plays the same beloved, you know, this is the model that works for radio. You know, people need to tune in every market to hear the variety show they love on Saturday night to hear Jack Benny or whatever.
When my mom talks about her family sitting around listening to the radio with her granddad is one of her formative kind of reference points when talking about intimacy. The family got together in the living room to listen to the radio. And it was really the only time that they weren't either working, eating, or sleeping.
Well, TV kind of had TV almost had a fireplace vibe. People called it the electronic hearth because just as the family would sit and knit and stare at the dying embers, you could stare at Ernie Kovacs, you know, or Jackie Gleason.
But what is this DuMont business? I am a student of American culture and I have never even heard of
this. Is that
true? Well, I don't think so.
Well, that's kind of why it's perfect omnibus fodder. This show was requested by a listener named Darwin, who I think he really wanted us to do the whole show on one specific DuMont program, which I'll mention in a second. But I thought the idea of a forgotten TV network, which was in 1947, up there with NBC as the front runner, DuMont should have been the future of television.
What if they had just called themselves DBC?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, if you're going to have a three-letter acronym and you're DuMont, you're D-U-M. It's not great, right?
No. But it's like the Seattle Lake Union or the South Lake Union trolley.
But this is before. Yeah, exactly. It's not really called the South Lake Union trolley.
It was for a minute.
So DuMont was the name. The namesake of DuMont was a brilliant engineer named Alan DuMont, and the company thrived basically on the success of his keen mind and sense of the future.
Is this part of the great man theory of civilization?
Yes, okay. Except we're going to see him fail. So does that help?
Yeah, sure.
Does that make it more relevant?
As long as he's white.
Alan DuMont is an 11-year-old in Brooklyn in 1912, pushing a hoop down the street.
That's right.
When at the age of 11, he gets polio, you know, the common story of his generation, which means he spends long parts of his early teen years in bed building a crystal radio set. Polio, I think, was the engine that maybe led to the American century, you know, because it made all these kids into indoor kids, and they all invented, they all founded Fortune 500 companies.
Yeah. In the 1970s, I spent all of my 11th year in bed, but I was just playing with G.I. Joes.
Well, you know, that actually, there's something to this, because the second boom would have been the late 70s and 80s kids that spent all their indoor time, not because they were sickly, but because they had a PC.
Yeah. Or watching Alice.
No. See, you were watching... Alice. You were watching Alice.
Yeah.
But they were programming in BASIC.
Oh, and then they developed.
15, 20 years later, there's voila, a new American economy.
So you're saying that computers are the polio of the late 20th century?
Well, it makes me wonder if, you know, because we had our own polio. Like, is Gen Z going to have some COVID-like turn to indoor kids things that fuels a new economy? Or did it just break them all?
No, all those kids now are making like really short videos of themselves lip syncing to pop songs.
And is that it? Is that the next 50 years of American economy?
Name another thing we make anymore. I mean, if you think about it.
We make TikToks
now. The thing is, AI is going to be writing all of the sitcom scripts. So what do humans make?
In the case of Alan Dumont, it starts a lifetime love affair with radio, and he actually ships out as a radio guy, a wireless operator on maybe a Navy ship? I can't remember if it's Merchant Marine. But after World War II, he comes back and gets an electrical engineering degree probably before the war. He gets an electrical engineering degree at RPI, and he is...
Yeah, if he was born in 1900
or something. Yeah, it would have been before the war. I think it's kind of World War I era. He's sailing the high seas, and then he comes home and gets his degree.
Take it.
And he's basically just an inventor and a gadgeteer from the youngest of ages, except now it's not that kind of kid doesn't do it with pulleys and Rube Goldberg stuff anymore, because he can mail order transistors and stuff. Well, not the transistor yet, but he can mail order components and build little
tubes.
Machines.
Can you declare yourself a gadgeteer, or is that something you have to earn?
Do you think you have to write into some kind of National Institute of Gadgeteers?
Yeah, because I had never heard that phrase until today, and I can't claim that I'm a gadgeteer, but I do know gadgeteers.
Wait, you're saying you heard that phrase today when I just said it?
Yeah, I've never heard that.
Did I make it up?
Gadgeteers, I love it.
Is it like a fan of Inspector Gadget?
I feel like it is something you should be able to... like a title you should be able to earn.
But there should be a Kentucky Colonel's like organizing body saying, no, you're not a gadgeteer.
Yeah.
Come back when you're a real gadgeteer. Exactly. Show me your best gadget.
Show me how many, what it's not Lincoln Logs. It's not.
Tinker Toys? Oh, Erector Sets.
Erector Sets.
There you go.
Show me how many Erector Sets you use to turn on the light bulb in your room.
But Dumont would have been a certified gadgeteer. His first invention, I think when he's still in his teens, is something that lets you turn off the radio by clapping.
The clapper.
He invented the clapper in like 1920. Basically.
Clap on.
Because it was relatively easy to buy a component that where a sharp enough sound would complete the circuit.
That's smart.
He he's ahead of the country on all this stuff. He joins Westinghouse, then moves to DeForest, and turns them both into radio tube giants. Like he just multiplies by an order of magnitude their output.
Westinghouse tubes were still until. Not very long ago.
Like Westinghouse was still making tubes?
Yeah, well, I don't know how long ago they stopped, but we used them in our guitar amps.
Somebody's got to be still making them. Just somebody in China now?
Oh, I'm afraid, my friend, if you talked to the gadgeteer down in Burien that fixed my synthesizer.
He's got to find them in a warehouse somewhere because nobody makes
them. He was yelling and screaming about how the Soviets don't make tubes anymore and nobody in America does.
It's all Reagan's fault for ending the Cold War.
And then the Chinese don't do it either, and so you're never going to be able to find any tubes. And I went online and I was like, tubes. And the 100 places were like, we'll sell you tubes. So I don't know. You can't confirm or deny.
Maybe he just won't use Vietnamese tubes due to personal convictions all his own.
I mean, there aren't that many reasons to make tubes.
Huh.
What are the things that use tubes? Guitar amps.
But there's probably people who have other vintage things they need to keep up, right?
Yeah, like little televisions.
Like your girlfriend.
Yeah. No, I didn't need tubes hipsters. To keep up my girlfriend, but yeah. There. But like most things, like nobody makes magnetic tape anymore because it's too expensive to do relative to the super niche group of people that want it.
I mean, there's often a big enough group that you will hear the complaints, 100,000 people still wanted to buy Polaroid film, and that just wasn't enough.
Well, a decade ago, everybody took the record pressing plants and dumped them into the ocean.
Yeah.
And then, or two decades ago.
Now we need them all.
Yeah. It's like, well, who's going to make those long winter
America's record pressing gap. There is a, we have a vinyl gap.
We do have a vinyl gap.
So
he's looking at the big board.
If we're okay with the great man theory of the rise of radio and TV, it's largely Alan Dumont getting these industries up to speed and making enough of these that America can have one in its living room.
This one guy.
And he's made his fortune. He leaves Westinghouse into Forest in order to set up his own shingle. He wants to, you know, he's an American entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Sets up in his garage because he thinks the future is cathode ray tubes.
Yes.
Now, you and I know that CRTs are going to power American televisions until the, you know, nearly the end of the century. But at the time, the market for them is oscillographs.
Okay.
If you're a physics lab, John, in 1930, and I grant me for a moment, it's a big if, but yeah. Grant me for a moment, like, and you want to monitor electrical current changing, you need, you know, nobody has a little video screen for that. You know, an industry had to be created so that these labs could watch current change, or else you couldn't do even the most basic, like, electromagnetic type experimentation.
Have you ever had cause to use an oscilloscope?
I've watched videos of them. I've seen them in kiddie hands-on science museums. Have you ever actually done science with one?
Well, it is not maybe something you would have thought, but it is a thing that we use in music.
For tonal
reasons? It shows you, particularly in mastering a record, it allows you to look at an entire song. Mm-hmm. And see, you know, frequency range and anomalies. And you'll watch, if you ever sit and watch a record be mastered, you know, the mastering engineer will refer to an oscilloscope.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I just think of him pushing those little Star Trek transporter knobs.
That too. But, you know, all those knobs, like you do one click on it and it really, to a mastering engineer, he really hears like, oh, wow, everything. I'm just going to pop a little thing over here. And the oscilloscope is, I mean, it's not like they sit and stare at it, but it is
part of the equipment. I would sit and stare at it there. If I'm high, like a recording engineer probably is.
I sit and stare at them for sure.
At the time, American cathode ray tube technology is just in the toilet. They're hard to produce. They're expensive to produce. Ours are bad. So we're importing them from Germany. It's really keeping physics labs back. But what, Dumont has a bad time, you know, in his first year, he makes $70 off his nascent CRT business, but he starts to realize there is a nascent market for this, that, if commercial television were to catch on, then suddenly America would need, 1,000 times, 10,000 times the cathode ray tubes that its previous appetite was. And he starts to ramp up, and really it's his work on producing more cathode ray tubes and better ones that makes American commercial television possible. There's a lot of people who were the guy, but in this case, he's the guy because you don't have a TV without a CRT. In 1938, his company, his $70 a year company, is now big enough that Paramount is interested in buying him out. So he sells a half interest to Paramount Pictures because they want a TV network and they think we'll just partner with this engineering lab. And then we can both sell the TVs and put the shows on the TVs.
So the movie theaters were already hip to the idea that if they owned the TVs.
Well, remember, they were vertical back then, too. Like, they owned the Paramount Theater in every city, and right. they would force that theater to show their musical or
so
whatever.
So Paramount Plus was a thing they already were thinking about in 1940?
They're like, let's make old people watch Yellowstone.
Wow. So into this.
So suddenly Dumont is not just making tubes. Now he's like, maybe we should start buying stations in a lot of East Coast cities.
Uh-huh,
so he starts to become a TV magnate. In 1939, Dumont Labs makes its first, the first large screen home TV receiver. And by large screen, you got a guess here?
6 inches.
You're very close. 14 inches is the game changing giant TV.
So, and that's measured diagonally. 14 inches.
I would assume.
Wow. That would be big relative to the ones we were looking at.
Yeah. It doesn't need a little, one of those prism things that you're, that gets your girlfriend, hot and bothered.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a Dumont joint. The very first workable home screens are Dumont. In 1946, after this interregnum for the war, this all stops during the war. money's just not going into it for whatever reason. Nobody sees a military application, I guess.
Oh, and cathode ray tubes weren't being used in early radar or early...
Maybe that's what happened. Everybody needed the oscillographs and the oscilloscopes, but it was not for sending video over the air. Yeah. Anyway, 1946, we can start using our tubes for baseball again, and it's Dumont again that has the first post-war TV on the market. He beats everybody else to market with the first post-World War II TV.
Good man.
And he debuts his new network, the Dumont Network. He's in New York. He's in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, it turns out to be crucial. Bunch of East Coast cities.
As per usual.
In 1949, so Pittsburgh is actually what staves off bankruptcy for Dumont for a long time. Like, they have the only VHF, you know, New York's a crowded market, Philadelphia, whatever, but Chicago, but Pittsburgh, they've got a real, they're like a kaiju that has a stranglehold on Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
And
which at the time was a major city in America, industrial powerhouse.
It is, and it's strategically located, because at the time, there's no way to get your programming, you know, if you broadcast something in New York, how do you network it to the rest of the country?
Right.
In the early days, you know, basically they would receive it by antenna and then rebroadcast it. Sometimes with as primitive a technology as just pointing a camera at the screen playing it.
Really?
So the quality would degrade as it moved westward to Chicago.
Right. But from Pittsburgh.
Well, Dumont. So there's no coaxial cable connecting New York and Chicago.
I knew that.
There probably is today, but there sure wasn't in the early 40s. But that's the solution, to run coax between cities. So when...
just laying on the ground?
Yeah, maybe they...
strung it up. They put it on the
wire. It's on power lines like a telegraph wire. Okay. Yeah. So once you run coax between... Pittsburgh was the golden spike, basically.
Yeah.
That let Dumont connect New York and Chicago. And now the big hits from Chicago, Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, could immediately make it to the East Coast. And Dumont was, and the other way around, more crucially, the other way around, all the big New York variety shows that were coming from radio.
Well, you're saying Kukla, Fran, and Ollie wasn't the thing that was driving the culture?
Imagine something even bigger than a sock puppet of a dragon.
Were you old enough to watch Kukla, Fran, and Ollie on television?
How old do you think I am?
I watched it.
Did it go that long? Was it reruns on Nick at Night? What are you watching?
I think it was still on. Was it not still on?
It could have been.
I think it was still on. Ken, did you know that Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for building your brand and growing your audience / business / presence online?
I would like to grow all three of those things, especially my presence.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I could stand it if you grew your presence anymore, at least in this enclosed room.
I like other people to give me presents.
Well, one way to expand your audience / business / presence is to stand out with a beautiful website.
Agreed.
And engage your audience and sell them your products, your content, and even your time.
Well, how does Squarespace help me do that? Like, do I need to figure out how like e-tail works and set up my own online store myself? That seems hard.
Well, it would be hard unless you had Squarespace, where you can sell physical, digital, and service products, and Squarespace provides you the tools you need to start selling online. You can upload, organize, and access all your content from one place. And with flexible website templates, you can get started with a professional website with designs for every category and use case, and then customize the look, the content, and features to fit your unique needs.
They've got the templates all ready to go, and then I can customize it?
That's right.
That sounds ideal. But what if some of those assets, what if some of my content is video? Squarespace can't handle video, can it?
Well, they sure can, my friend. Video content and a video library are part of the Squarespace experience. You can showcase your content on beautiful video pages and sell access to your videos with member areas.
Ooh, special member areas. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to head to squarespace.com/omnibus for a free trial. You should do this too. When you're ready to launch, just use offer code omnibus and you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
That's right. If you're in there working in squarespace.com, rest assured Ken is somewhere else in squarespace.com also fooling around. You won't be able to see him. But you'll both be in there fooling around together.
We'll be in the Matrix together. Maybe we'll be playing with the same template. And that's intimacy today. That's friendship, basically.
You guys are in some cultures. Go to squarespace.com/omnibus And when you're ready, use the offer code Omnibus and you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
I mean, TV, you really can't overstate how cheap and bad TV is back then.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say this because it's my métier, but it's a lot of game shows. The very first night that commercial broadcasts licenses were granted by the FCC, everybody showed game shows because they were already putting them on radio.
Cheap to make.
They were super cheap to make. All you needed was a panel of people asking questions and you were good. It's the same reason why Jeopardy and Wheel are the most watched TV shows in America today. They're inexpensive. They're inoffensive. They're background for your life.
Right.
So Dumont is first to the Golden Spike, and they can connect the East and the Midwest, which is a huge Neil Armstrong-like thing. By 1951, Alan Dumont is the first millionaire in TV.
Hooray, Alan Dumont! Person I had never heard of until 20 minutes ago.
Dumont is a $75 million a year company, just turning out TVs from its four New Jersey plants, you know, selling TVs all over America. In 1954, they've opened the lavish Dumont Telecenter on the Upper East Side of New York, Lenox Hill, where all their programming originates.
Have you been to the Radio and Television Museum in New York?
I have not. The Paley one where you can watch old stuff?
Yeah. Oh, I don't believe that you haven't been there. It's incredible. You need to go immediately. What are we doing here? Let's get on a plane right now. It's really incredible. It really is like a library archive.
I can't believe I haven't been.
I know. It's so Ken, and you're right there. It's just right in the middle of Midtown.
I'm going to be in New York in September. I'll probably go.
You should. You should. But make a note of it.
I'll report back.
Okay.
Now, you may be wondering, mm-hmm. why are NBC and Dumont so far ahead of the game? Like, where are ABC and CBS?
Because CBS had Edwin R. Murrow.
CBS was the biggest radio presence, you know? Yeah. They're the Columbia Broadcasting Service. They are, well, ABC's as a more recent addition, they were an NBC spinoff, an antitrust, government antitrust suit.
Which portion of NBC spun off?
NBC had two radio networks at the time. I think they called them Blue and Red. And the government was like, no, you don't. So the government forces NBC Blue to become ABC. And they are hamstrung because they just don't have their own New York station because they're a Johnny Come Lately.
Thanks, Obama.
Exactly. They don't have a New York station. And that's just, in a New York-centric America, you just can't compete. So they're basically, they have nowhere, that's where most of the TVs are, and they can't air shows to them. So they're basically producing their own shows on other stations just for practice. So that someday when they get it, you know, including Dumont. Dumont is airing ABC game shows just because ABC is like, someday we're going to be a network. We promise. We're going to have Happy Days. We're going to have the Ropers.
See, that's why you can't tax the rich.
Because
otherwise they won't have the time and luxury to practice TV.
To practice making a TV network.
Until they finally are a TV.
If Rupert Murdoch hadn't had all that time, you know, think how bad a state we'd be in.
Where else would the Howard Stern show have incubated?
CBS is huge, but they are holding out for color TV. They're pulling
that early.
Yeah, they're pulling a Betamax play. So the current standard that everybody else is using would not have supported color TV. And CBS thinks this is our category killer. We can kill off the other broadcasting networks. If we can persuade America to buy into a new color standard, then everybody else will be playing catch up for a decade.
They have to be able to do that before everybody invests in a black and white TV, right? It's not like...
Right. Well, maybe.
These are expensive.
Maybe you'll get people to upgrade. But yeah. Basically what you're forcing is all your network broadcasting competitors to have infrastructure that's no damn good anymore.
I see.
And what unfortunately, as we know, a color TV did not appear in the mid-40s because a government ruling went against their tech and they became the... CBS's attempt became Betamax, and suddenly they were playing catch-up.
You're telling me that the technology of color television was there in the 40s?
The technology of color TV exists in the 20s. It just wasn't baked into the broadcasting standards. Like, everyone understood how it would work.
Why?
It's got to be efficiency of production, I think. And it was bad. Like, here's the reason why TV didn't catch on. The essential reason is not just that the shows are bad, but that the technology is bad. It's fuzzy. The signal doesn't carry. It's not just that there's nothing to watch, but it sucks to watch it.
It's like battery-powered cars in 1905.
It's the same reason why computer bulletin boards took 20 years to become the internet, because it was slow, it took up your phone line. It wasn't just that there was...
just that they were bad, because it's still bad.
It's still bad.
It's maybe worse.
It's not just that there was nowhere good to go. It was also that it was a nightmare to get there, and it failed, and it took specialized equipment.
Run by neckbeards.
Yeah. So Dumont, so CBS and ABC are like way behind NBC and Dumont, Dumont has hit shows. In the late 40s, they win the Hooper ratings, which were the precursor to today's Nielsen ratings.
That also seems like a future omnibus episode.
The Hooper ratings?
The Hooper ratings.
We should do the Nielsen ratings. How have we not? That's about to be forgotten.
Let's do.
With all the streaming shows keeping their ratings under their hats so they don't have to pay.
Do you want a Rochambeau anybody? Who gets to do the Nielsen ratings? It's much more of a Ken show.
No, I think maybe you should do it and I can use it to grouse about streaming ratings.
Where I'm like, apparently there was a thing.
They won the Hooper ratings in, I don't know, 48 or 49 for Ted Mack's Amateur Hour, kind of a talent contest, American Idol type show that had come from radio. They had the first sitcoms, Mary Kay and Johnny, the Goldbergs, not the new one. They had the first network soap opera, Faraway Hill.
You're like, this is like alternate universe.
I know, right? A better version of the 40s, a steampunk 40s. And here's the real steampunk. They had the first science fiction show, and it was a huge hit. Have you heard of Captain Video and his Video Rangers?
That sounds like a 1980s, like, sort of Night Flight show. Captain Video!
You have to go to your KFC or Taco Bell and get some red and blue glasses so you can watch it.
Yeah, it stars Super Dave Osborne.
No, this was the first science fiction show on American television, and it was huge. It was intended for kids, but they ended up having to program it later and later because
weirder and weirder.
Because dads were watching it because there was an appetite for pulp sci-fi that covered a ton of ages and there was no TV show.
Right. Now, and this is the Harlan Ellison days when sci-fi could get really, really creepy.
It was actually written by all the pulp writers you would recognize. Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and all these guys wrote for Captain Video and his Video Rangers.
This cannot be true.
And there
this
are
whole story you're telling.
There me. Are 1500. Well, there aren't, but there were 1500 episodes of this show about this futuristic do-gooder, Captain Video.
How many episodes of Twilight Zone? Are there?
Well, it's 5 30 show seasons. This, let's say, an order of magnitude less, 1/10 as many Twilight Zones as Captain Video and his Video Rangers.
Do they only survive at the Television Museum in New York?
Only a handful survive for reasons I will elaborate on in a moment. Sadly. I think about 15 maybe are left and they're not good. Don't get me wrong. Like Twilight Zone is prestige TV where the greatest playwright of his day, Rod Serling, is trying his hand at Tales of the Macabre and Uncanny. And that's the secret sauce. This is dumb. Guys in cardboard robot suits. There's no special effects because Captain Video is aired live. It's a live science fiction show. Can you imagine?
Whoa. So it's like a play. It's like a theater. Like
it's a little play.
Like a home theater.
And they've got a $15 a day budget to make their little ray guns out of. So nothing good can happen. As the show takes off, I think eventually there's no effects at first. Eventually they finally find some gadgeteers to make little 16mm insert shots of spaceships that they can...
Right.
That they can drop in.
Or triangle wipes or whatever it was we were still using in the 80s. Diamond wipe.
So this is like a category killing show. It's got...
It runs from when to when?
Let's see. Captain...
1,500 episodes. Was it like daily?
It was 5 times a week. Wow. It aired from 1949 until 1955. Monday through Saturday.
Whoa. So my older brother... would have watched this show. Oh, did they have it in Seattle?
Let's see.
Dumont?
Dumont had a coast-to-coast hookup. Like, so I'm pretty confident you could watch Captain Video in L.A. I wonder about Seattle. I assume so.
I mean, we were not on any American map at the time.
We were a logging town.
Yeah.
Yeah. Captain Video fought, kind of faux yellow peril, yellow face villains. He also fought Ernest Borgnine in one of his earliest roles as, one of his arch enemies,
Fought McHale's Navy.
What was the guy's name? Nargola. Before Borgnine is a Oscar winner for Marty, he's a struggling New York actor playing twisting his mustache on Captain Video. And weirdly, the show had been, they had purchased the rights to all these screen Westerns and had announced that this was supposed to be a Western show. Captain Video was supposed to be the host who said, all right, kiddos, let's see what happened with that Stagecoach robbery from yesterday. And then they would show some Roy Rogers thing they had bought the rights to. He was just supposed to be Krusty the Clown. But the future stuff turned out so good that Captain Video turned out the show, became the show. But still, without warning, they'd come back from commercial and there'd still be 10 minutes of Wild West action. And then without explanation, Captain Video would reappear and continue his story. So I'm not saying that it was the most discerning audience. It was a deeply weird show. So it was a mass hit.
It was available here on KRSC. Channel 5.
That may not have been a Dumont affiliate. You know, in some stations that didn't have.
It says that it played stuff from all networks: ABC, NBC, CBS, and Dumont. So it was a television station that just. Yeah, was
here on the frontier.
Yeah,
the government, as we'll see, was limiting how many owned and operated stations these places could run themselves. And so, if they didn't have a full time affiliate, yeah, they would just sell shows to whoever had a transmitter.
What's crazy is that you could watch it in Alaska.
Kids love Captain Video.
KTVA, which is still an operating television station.
All that kind of A Christmas Story radio nostalgia of the kids who grew up listening to these adventures, Captain Video is a huge part of that. Wow. Like Dave Barry will not shut up about, you know, sending away for his Captain Video Dakota Ring and all this stuff. It was the Star Trek of the 50s.
I may think of it as an 80s thing because in the 80s, the boomers were writing all the humor columns.
Exactly.
And so I was like, I'm sure I read Dave Barry talk about Captain Video and I thought he was just having a goof.
It was a real thing. It just, the name. Their biggest star, you know, at the time, TV's now mass culture, particularly Milton Berle owns Tuesday Night. Uncle Milty and the Texaco Star Theater is... He's Mr. Television.
You know, I like to think that Milton Berle still owns my Tuesday nights.
Do you think about him no matter what you're doing? You've got a hot date, but hey, baby.
Listen, the last thing I'm going to think about on a hot date is Milton Berle.
No, he's famously very masculine.
But that's not what I'm looking for on a hot date.
But Dumont was the first network that had a Milton Berle killer. They counter-programmed Texaco Star Theater with Life is Worth Living, starring... The Father Fulton. Oh, are you putting on Captain Video right now?
No, but that sounded like Captain Video.
It sounded like Fulton Sheen. He was a Catholic bishop, later archbishop, who actually had unlike a lot of the charisma-free people in every occupation of that time, uh-huh. was pretty good on camera. So he would give life-affirming 30-minute homilies about, citizenship and so forth.
But that's not anywhere near as fun as watching Milton Berle slapstick around.
It was Barbenheimer. It was counter-programming. You know, some households are not going to let the kids watch Uncle Milty do whatever low vaudeville stuff he's doing. They want something a little more edifying. And Fulton Sheen won Emmys for Dumont. I watched some clips of him, and he's really not ready for primetime. I was expecting to see a charismatic, maybe televangelist type, and he's very much Mr. Rogers. You wouldn't want to say Mr. Rogers has a simper, but he kind of has that quality to his voice where, you know, for many years, a lot of people who couldn't be free with their sexuality went into the priesthood. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to speculate about Bishop Sheen, but
I went to Jesuit school,
but he very much has that gentle affect. And he's wearing the full kind of purple and red robe. So he's got a cape. He looks like the bad guy in a Monty Python sketch or a Zorro serial. But he's comfortable improvising. He's got a very loose. Suddenly he'll just turn and start talking to the camera guy like Regis Philbin would, you know. but he's not slick in any way. But he was the big celebrity of Dumont. They could have been the fourth network. But as you know, John, we live in a worse future where that didn't happen.
Right.
What went wrong?
What did go wrong? What happened to Dumont?
Well, they were being propped up by their TV sale. I like how you say it in a French way.
Dumont.
They were being propped up by TV sales. And after 1958, that went into decline. I assume because of just more competition in the market. They were the classic early adopter that then got caught up too. And suddenly other people are making tubes and components and receivers. And now they don't have that cash cow to carry their losses. Because there were losses. Unlike, especially CBS and NBC, they did not have a radio network. DuMont never had a radio network.
Oh.
Because they were the forward-thinking guy who started making tubes and then was like, I should own affiliates.
Right. Why go backward in time?
Exactly. But that turned out to be a mistake because CBS and NBC could rely on their radio network for a talent pool. You know, suddenly they could put all your radio favorites on TV and they had a built-in audience. It was like the same reason that all movies today have to be a Barbie or a comic book.
When did it tip from radio to TV where the mass audience was on TV? Because people were still listening to radio.
Oh, sure. I feel like when does TV become where the culture is?
Yeah.
It's probably mid-50s. It's 55 or so.
Because even in the 80s, all the smart moms that had fuzzy sweaters were all listening to NPR all day.
Well, that's still true.
Is that true?
Mom's gonna mom, you know, like
mom's gonna mom.
I mean, they're listening to Omnibus. They're listening to podcasts.
There you go.
But no, NPR survived the radio collapse.
But
by Barbenheimer counterprogramming.
Other than Sarah Watkins and the Prairie Home Companion, I don't see NPR creating a lot of mass culture.
You're right, but you see in major American cities, you see enough tote bags and T-shirts to know what people have on in the car.
You got it. All you have to do is see in the old days, a Volvo, now it would be a Subaru Outback.
Right. I think the Volvos are back. So
only because you're driving a Volvo.
That's what defines what's cool in Seattle. What's Ken Jennings driving? So there is no talent pool, which means they have to pull all their stars from Broadway and hope that America will fall in love with, you know, more Amsterdam or whatever.
And did Paramount mob up with NBC? I mean, did the big studios make relationships with TV stations?
Okay, that was the problem. So they don't have a radio network, so they don't have a talent pool, they don't have the good affiliates, because often the radio and TV in a given market would go hand in hand, so they had to pick up the crumbs. But Paramount ownership turned out to be a real, what's the expression here?
Game changer?
No, something that's bad. Like that's your Achilles heel.
Achilles heel.
It turned out to be their Achilles heel. Paramount, so they could have survived when it was clear that they were losing money. They tried to do what UPN and WB did and merge with ABC. ABC was the distant third place network. They were like, between the two of us, we could beat CBS and NBC.
I thought what WB did was make a bunch of T-shirts with the Tasmanian devil on it.
Giant Walmart T-shirts with Tweety on them are keeping...
Didn't that keep the network afloat?
No, it turned out the WB and UPN were both trying to be the fifth network, and they were both too small, and then they combined to become the CW.
Yeah, right, okay.
Which
right.
I think meant combined...
Yeah, comedy...
Web.
Workspace.
Yeah, that's what it was. Paramount didn't want to do it. Paramount did not want to have a merger with ABC. So they vetoed that. And then there's all this regulatory stuff I didn't look up that basically limited how many VHS stations, owned and operated stations, that these big networks could own. And the FCC limit was 5, but because of Paramount's half ownership, DuMont did not get the full 5. Like they had to make do with 2 or 3.
Oh,
so complex regulatory scheming, meant that they always had this handicap.
And was DuMont himself running the operation through all this? Or was it just his namesake? Was he an exec?
I think he stayed CEO through the network times, although, you know, that's not his interest. You know, he still wants to be in the lab. So I assume there's TV men, advertising men in New York running that side of the business.
This is still the problem with founder-led tech companies. Founders are tech nerds, and they should stay in the lab and let...
They should Wozniak out.
Yeah.
But they all want to put on a black turtleneck.
I feel like I was just about to say, let business people run it, but I'm the sworn enemy of business people, so let the poets run it.
It turns out who you don't want running it is the fake tech guys who were never good at tech but are convinced that they're tech geniuses.
Yes, okay.
Somebody tell Elon he's not a gadgeteer.
Okay.
No,
he just bought a bunch of gadgeteers.
So that was the death knell for DuMont. And that's why it went down this memory hole. You know, a lot of its stars continued to be stars. Fulton Sheen went to ABC to great success.
Sure, everyone's still talking about Fulton Sheen.
I mean, he was on TV into the 80s, I think.
Fulton Sheen?
Fulton Sheen.
I don't know if I could pick him out of a crowd. Let's see if I recognize him.
No, you would not. But imagine a nicer Father Coughlin who's somewhere in the UHF reaches of the dial.
I see. Yeah.
The biggest star on
He really looks like a vampire.
He does, right?
Yeah.
The biggest star on the Dumont Network hosted their Cavalcade of Stars.
Okay.
And actually debuted many of his sketch characters there, including one in which he played a bus driver from Brooklyn called Ralph Cramden. Jackie Gleason's The Honeymooners actually started out on a Dumont variety show.
Really?
And then as Dumont contracted and then collapsed, or I think even before that, CBS offered Gleason more money. Dumont could not compete with the Tiffany Network, and they lost their big star.
But The Honeymooners was at one point the biggest television show in America, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that was after CBS got it. But you know, the famous Man from Space episode that you see in Back to the Future, that's actually a Captain Video joke. Ralph gets very into a daily sci-fi serial and dresses as a robot. On September 23rd, 1955, Dumont airs its last piece of original programming, a game show. They survived for a few years on pro sports contracts. They were airing some boxing out of Madison Square Gardens. And so they still continue that, but their affiliate network is dead. And the reason why we're thinking of this as an alternate history is because it's not just that the station went away. They left no cultural footprint at all.
Huh.
One of their successor networks inherited all their programming. You know, back then, the only way, if you're broadcasting something live on video, the only way to record it and then maybe get it to the Midwest or the other coast, if you're not going to just focus a camera at a screen, would be to focus a film camera at a screen and record on, you know, 16 or 35 millimeter film what the video feed is. So you get a lower quality version, but that's how I Love Lucy stuck around. Like, that's how I Love Lucy made it to the West Coast. We have these old shows because of the kinescope. So there was at one point a warehouse full of Dumont kinescopes, and then some successor network, I don't want to point the finger, I don't know who it was, bought the rights at a fire sale, didn't want to maintain the warehouse, and E.D. Adams, Ernie Kovacs's widow and actress, testified to Congress in the 90s that a series of trucks picked them up in the early 70s and just dumped the entire Dumont Network's output into the Hudson River. And, you know, there have been attempts to pull, you know, old rare wax cylinders or, you know, lost film out of rivers, and those have worked. But I don't know of any attempt to dredge the Hudson for 1,500 episodes of Captain Video or, or, you know, even historically important stuff, the first sitcom, the first soap opera.
But maybe the DJs of the future will be remixing video, and they'll pull that stuff out, and it'll be like the beats, like the soul beats that they started repurposing in the 80s.
Yeah, like the future archaeologists we're talking to. The Hudson River is no doubt dried up now.
Right.
Go into the mud. Go find... a Cavalcade of Stars, a lot of that stuff survived because the hosts kept copies. Gleason kept personal copies of his sketches, which is the only reason why we have those early Honeymooner sketches. Otherwise, they'd be at the bottom of the Hudson River, too.
Now, isn't that interesting to think of Jackie Gleason as having some warehouse somewhere that's just like his archives? I love that.
I mean, it's probably not as nice as your Paul Allen friend. It's probably a storage locker in the valley somewhere. But
yeah, well, Paul Allen just keeps building or kept building museums for his stuff.
There were some attempts to build out a fourth network because the collapse of Dumont basically left us with the cultural landscape you and I grew up in. NBC and CBS are top of the pops, and ABC is a scrappy underdog who, by the time of our lifetimes, is at parity with them.
And then PBS somehow never gets included in that conversation.
It wasn't. It's public.
Yeah,
John, those are our airwaves. But there were attempts over the years because there was enough cultural memory of Dumont for people to think there could be a fourth network. In 1966, now, have you ever heard of Daniel Overmeyer, who created the Overmeyer Network?
No.
Now, he's a rich man, but he made his money in the Toledo warehouse game.
Yep.
Biggest warehouse mogul in Toledo, Ohio, Daniel Overmeyer, decides that the culture is perverse and there should be more good old conservative entertainment.
Toledo was the Pittsburgh of its
That's
time,
right.
of the 60s.
And so he starts the Overmeyer Network, which later becomes the United Network. Their big show is a variety show from the Hotel Hacienda in Las Vegas, which is starting to become the new cultural capital. So he wants to get in on the ground floor of that.
Except it's got conservative values. Seems like the wrong place to focus your show.
Right. I guess it would be a very small subset of Vegas Cabaret Entertainment would be shown on the United Network. In 1964, Congress had required all new TVs, you know, for the good of competition, all new TVs bought in America had to have UHF tuners.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully, you know, leading to a
boom.
Yeah. It wouldn't just be the triopoly of
you know, my first job was at a UHF television station.
It was. That's right. And these were the kind of little, and you, so you know what those stations were airing, like whatever reruns they could get cheap.
Just nothing.
You know.
We had music videos, but those were just stolen from the back of a truck.
Do you think you guys had the rights to those? Maybe record companies didn't care. They'd let anybody show music videos.
I think that's what it was. I mean, we didn't have all the, every time Michael Jackson came out with a new video, we didn't have it. We were busy showing videos of bluegrass bands at Telluride Music Festival. But we did have a lot of the videos.
You had pop videos.
Yeah, a couple of years old.
You must have had deals with distributors.
Yeah, we did.
Well, in the 60s, it was even more dire. Like, there was nothing to show on these stations. And so Overmyer thought, you know, I'll just show my new programming on a bunch of these UHF stations. And that's effectively what the Overmyer network was. But it lasted exactly 1 month in 1967, I think. By that, the end of that month, it was $700,000 in debt, and Overmyer abruptly told affiliates, there's no more network. It just ended today.
Well, that explains why I don't remember it.
Yeah, that's even more memory hold than Dumont. And I think those two failures, Dumont and Overmyer, pretty much salted the earth for the idea of a fourth network until, this is the Gen X relevant part of our show.
Here we go.
October 1986.
Here comes the hero of the story.
Rupert Murdoch announces that he's going to renounce his Australian citizenship. There were laws on the books saying that you could not own more than 20% of a U.S. broadcasting license unless you had a U.S. pass, unless you were a U.S. citizen. And Rupert Murdoch decides, I know how to make the world a better place.
Yes.
I'll renounce Australian citizenship, and I will buy this broadcasting network called Metro Media, and I'll do something with it. Now the news network was still 10 years away. But you're watching the dominoes fall that lead to the end of civilization here. Joan Rivers had been guest hosting for Johnny Carson for the last decade. You know, he would take a night or two off a week and we would get Joan, and that was better than, you know, Joey Bishop or some roll of the dice.
Everybody, I'm going to say better than Joey Bishop.
Not even close. No. Like, Joan Rivers, very sharp comic.
Yes.
America loved her. Johnny loved her. And then suddenly, in October 1986, it was announced that she would be mounting a challenge to Johnny on the new Fox network.
Torpedoing their relationship forever.
Forever. They never spoke again. At the time, the networks were so convinced that you had to be an initialism that what is now Fox was FBC.
Really?
Joan Rivers was going to anchor the new FBC lineup by challenging Johnny Carson every night. Barry Diller, who was, I think, already running the Fox studio, said that we were going to have a new brand. We were going to be the network that had no censorship. So you smart, edgy creatives, bring your ideas to us. We're the No Cosbys network, you know, because at the time, the name Cosby was synonymous with conservative values and not edgy behavior, which is the opposite of today.
This was like the PJ O'Rourke era where conservatives really thought they were the ones that were speaking truth to power, which then went away for a long time and now is back.
It's back.
Yeah.
Even though they don't have the celebs to go with it.
Right.
They're doing it with just no, on the no back. Big, they're on the on Jim Caviezel's back.
No big celebs like PJ O'Rourke. Dennis Miller.
And so this is what leads to Fox Network actually mounting what turned out to be a successful challenge to the oligopoly.
Well, now how did Murdoch acquire Fox? How did that relationship happen? Because you said, I'm sorry, you said Murdoch, blah, 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 something about the Metro network.
So the previous year, his News Corp had acquired 20th Century Fox.
Okay.
So he already owns the movie studio.
Even before
and he's moving onto the airwaves.
He leaves Australia.
The year before, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it was around the same time, but clearly he's making a play for a bigger market. You know, he can ruin the world from Australia, but he can do it much faster from New York and LA.
And Fox came with all of the incredible library of 20th Century Fox stuff.
So that stuff you can air on cable, and their broadcast channel is going to be, it's going to be cooler. It's going to be dirtier. It's not Cosby. It's Married with Children. You know, that was their that was their big hit, you know, just an openly dumb and raunchy sitcom.
Yes.
You know, that makes Three's, you know, you watch Three's Company now and you can't believe that, anybody was clutching their pearls over that show.
Yeah. It was really, really scary how clean they were.
How clean cut those threats to the order were.
I mean, Jack Tripper did a lot of biting on his knuckles, like,
instead of SNL, they had In Living Color, which is, you know, at that time,
Living Color,
cooler by definition because it's young, talented black comics.
Right.
And they had Tracy Ullman, a comedian no one had heard of on a network nobody had heard of.
Right. Although that's where.
Yeah. That's why Fox is still around. Tracy Ullman, the people running the Tracy Ullman show, I think Jim Brooks specifically, made the decision to call in a favorite alt cartoonist of his. And ask if he would do some animated interstitials, and everybody knows where this ends. Reed graduate Matt Groening debuts The Simpsons based on his own childhood memories, just as, you know, going to commercials between sketches on the Tracy Ullman show. And in 1989, Matt becomes its own show, and suddenly Fox is not just a going, it's not just a possibility, but a real, you know, the center of the culture. It's,
so this
it's tomorrow.
Was. Which came first? Did the family one?
Tracy, what? Married with Children?
Married with Children. Did
Married
that
with
come
Children
first?
Predates The Simpsons.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cause I remember Married with Children debuting and feeling like, oh, this is super edgy. Like,
yeah, we were the exact right age to be like, yeah, take that, Parents Council of America.
But it didn't take long to feel like, oh, this is just poop jokes. It's just like. Like anything with poop jokes. It's not that edgy.
Simpsons did the joke where Al and Peg Bundy kind of whine about not having sex for a minute, and then Al leans over and flushes a toilet, which is in the living room next to his chair, for no reason. And yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. But they Although didn't, Peg Bundy, pretty sexy.
We love Katie Sagal, don't we? But they already had The Simpsons by then. Their ticket was punched. And so America is no longer a three-network oligopoly. And of course, the incredible proliferation of streaming platforms and cable broadcasters, which, you know, who knows where that will end.
Now, wait, are you telling me that Fox survived and succeeded because of The Simpsons?
That's essentially true.
Really?
I think. If you look at the Nielsen ratings of those first years of Fox, there's nothing that would keep, you know, there's nothing that would make affiliates happy.
So we have George Meyer to blame for the way the culture has fallen apart?
Yeah, our friend who's a Simpsons writer is, I guess what you're saying is, would Murdoch have started Fox News if FBC had failed?
Yeah.
He probably would have. We can't blame the Simpsons writers for that.
Okay.
Because he was already News Corp. You know, he was already a tabloid.
But
dope.
Would he have gone out of business is the million-dollar question, like everyone who came before.
Like the Toledo warehouse mogul?
Yeah.
Like Alan Dumont? That's a nice world to imagine where they don't hire Matt Groening. The Tracy Ullman show lasts a year. Fox shuts down. Murdoch is, you'd like to say sitting in an alley somewhere, but sitting on a beach somewhere.
Yeah.
Not making TV.
I will say to any futurelings who have not listened to Tracy Ullman's cover of They Don't Care About Us, one of the great songs of the 80s.
You recommend it.
And I think you should Spotify it immediately.
The punchline, since we like to have a punchline on this show, it's not, you know, it could be a Tracy Ullman deep cut. Why mm-hmm. not? Mm-hmm. But, you know, Fox is now the fourth network. Their flagship New York affiliate runs from the Fox Television Center at 205 East 67th Street on the Upper East Side.
Not encouraging you to go there and throw paint.
No, you want to pick at Fox News on 6th Avenue.
Oh, okay.
This is just where this is the Fox Television Center of the Fox network. That building is in fact the former Dumont Telecenter, opened to much acclaim in 1954.
No kidding. Is it a 1954 building? Is it like an internationalist style skyrise?
That is exactly what I'm picturing. And I think I've done TV in that building.
You have done TV in that building.
Not Dumont era.
You've gone on a talk show or something on Fox.
Yeah, I mean not. I've been on Fox and Friends down at the Fox News thing, but I don't think I'm their friend anymore.
What did you do?
What did I do?
Yeah, what did you do?
To not be their friend anymore?
Yeah, why are you not friends with Fox and Friends?
I feel like I'm the same. I think they changed. Oh, I think the culture changed. The Fox and Friends moved away from me.
They used to be like, Ken Jennings, come on down and we'll talk about fun stuff.
Yeah, we'll just talk about game shows. Now it's like, hey, wouldn't you agree that the libs are trying to steal my kids' lymph?
Yeah. Your delicious kids' lymph.
Delicious lymph. And that was when I walked off the set. I didn't have a lot of lymph material.
And that concludes the Dumont Network, entry 386.LK2417, certificate number 28450 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are not things that we talk about anymore. But you can find periodic posts at Omnibus Project. You can still find Ken Jennings and John Roderick on Instagram. I am no longer on Twitter. Ken, you're starting to wean off of X, aren't you?
I'm pretty half-hearted on all of the above.
Yeah. But on Facebook, oh my gosh, there is a very active and super fun group of futurelings hanging out, posting pictures, talking about stuff. You can also find groups affiliated, futureling groups on Reddit and Discord.
There's a new Discord, I hear.
And other funky places, people posting themselves singing along with Ken Jennings.
Singing along with Tracy Ullman.
And John Roderick, hopefully. Send me those fractions of a penny. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. That's where this show came from. Oh, no, this was a Patreon suggestion.
It was.
And you can send us suggestions if you are a subscriber to our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. That's only one of many perks that contributing even a small token amount to our podcast will grant you. Although suggesting a topic requires that you subscribe at a slightly higher amount, but it's great value for your dollar.
A dollar a week gets you an additional show every month, which is pretty good.
Pretty great. Pretty great. Considering how fun those additional shows are.
We love the addenda.
Where we read your letters and make fun of them.
I can't believe you, who don't subscribe to the Patreon, are still listening to these lesser weekly shows.
No, these are great shows.
Instead of the amazing, amazing four-pay addenda shows.
You can send us actual mail to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. It looks like you've got another stack of postcards over there.
Derek actually went to Trieste, although, oh no, this is a postcard from Trieste. I think on Trieste. Your say-so, John.
Yes, and?
Listening to you wax poetic about it cemented his decision to visit. It is a lovely city reflecting its long 19th century heyday under the Habsburgs. So, you know, he knew what you would like, Habsburg content.
Excellent. Thank you so much for making that trip, Derek, and I will follow you.
Stefan has a two-year-old. Stefan sent us this amazing postcard of Que lindo es Ichoacán, el paraíso de México, some classic movie from the golden age of Mexican cinema, apparently, starring the great Tito Guizar.
Mm-hmm.
Good-looking guy.
He's great.
But, you know, by Mexican movie star standards. But Stefan's note is unrelated to this film. He just wants us to know that his two-year-old loves to dance to the omnibus music, but it's too short to keep him occupied because it only plays, I guess, from about the 49-second mark to the minute 11 mark. And he wants to dance for more than 22 seconds. Haven't we done this at some point? Didn't we have an extended dance remix of the wee?
I think so. There definitely is a longer version of it. I think that someone on the Futurelings page could absolutely take what is there and loop it and turn it into an MP3 for your child to dance to.
Stefan, head to the Facebook's Futurelings page and see if anyone has hooked you up there. And please send us video of Charlie cutting a rug to the longer version of the theme. We also got a note from Rich, who wishes us many goods and cheese, and notes that the enclosed has no direct connection to anything relating to Omnibus.
Well done. How could you even find a thing that hasn't at least been mentioned once?
He implies that Omnibus is more of a vibe than a set of entries, which is probably true.
I know. I disagree. We're a set of entries. We're not a vibe. Are we a vibe?
Well, he asks if we have an appreciation for unique and or specialized forms of transportation. Absolutely. Right?
I think pretty clearly.
We're like, this podcast is 75% funicular railways, right?
Yeah.
Well, he wants us to know, let's see, the Conservancy. He must work for the E.M. Cotter Conservancy.
Is this like a fireboat restoration group?
Sent us, yeah, some books of beautiful. He sent us two copies of this book of beautiful photographs for the Edward M. Cotter, the world's oldest working fireboat.
Wow.
Which has been patrolling Buffalo's waterfront.
It's beautiful.
Since 1900.
Look at that beautiful fireboat. You know, our fireboat is not that much younger than that fireboat.
I do like to watch our fireboat.
Yes.
But, well, look how red the BFD one is here.
You sent me a text only a few days ago, a fireboat related text.
I did.
And
the fireboat was welcoming the fleet into Elliott Bay.
Yeah, you were
at, for Seattle's annual seafare.
Jury duty, and you were like, why is this fireboat and this fleet puttering around Elliott Bay? And because I was King Neptune.
I knew you had the seafare deets.
I did have the deets. And fireboats play a big role in Puget Sound. They always have. We've always, our oldest fireboat is the Duwamish. And even.
What year?
Well, when I was a kid, we always let, so 1909.
So Buffalo beat us by 9 years.
They did.
What I want to do is go set fire to this thing, and then the Duwamish will be.
Oh, okay. All right, I see what you're saying.
But look how beautiful the Edward M. Cotter is.
It is.
Beautiful. Is our fireboat red and white like
that? No, it's our fireboat, like most Washington boats, is white and green.
Yeah, look at this white stripes ass fireboat. That is
a hot fireboat.
It's amazing.
And you know, they look somewhat similar. You know, if you
it's probably the same tech. It's the same era.
So, if you put in oldest fireboat, you do get the E.M. Cotter. But if you put in oldest fireboats, well, that's going to take me a little bit longer to figure out, like, how old the Duwamish is.
Because there's a band called the Oldest Fireboats.
I'm going to start making records again.
Do you think like we have a first one? No, we can't have one that predates Great Lakes fireboats, right?
Okay. Well, there's actually on this website a list of famous fireboats. Can you believe that?
It's a very low level of fame, I would say. Fireboat fame is like worse than internet fame.
So the Abram S. Hewitt is a New York City one from 1903. So the Duwamish is
not in second place.
Not in second place.
Alas. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we so fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.